Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining Tag Sustainability Talk. You're here with Courtney Crumby and Aaron LaQuay, co-founder and CEO of EnviroSpark. And we are here today to talk about what it's like to build and scale an EV-focused clean technology company in today's environment. So thank you so much for joining us, Aaron. Do you want to just give a quick little introduction?
Well, it's fun to be on. I'm Aaron LaQuay, founder and CEO of EnviroSpark. We're a EV charging-focused company. We're trying to make infrastructure available in order to promote EV adoption. So our primary objective is to try to encourage people to consider getting an electric car, because one of the main things that we've found in terms of what's preventing ownership and adoption is people being afraid they're going to get stuck somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so for us, we set out to solve that problem, you know, almost 10 years ago now. And you know, we take a lot of pride in the role that we played in helping kind of make this transition happen in the sustainability sector. And we've had the opportunity to help build national networks for Tesla and Volkswagen and the federal government in order to help with that electrification movement. So that's a little bit about who we are. I don't know if that's
awesome. That's great, yeah.
What you're looking for, but...
Yeah, I mean, I drive a Tesla, and we haven't taken many long road trips because some areas still don't have that infrastructure, so it's great to see the change starting to go forward. Let's start with a little bit about your background and the milestones in your career that led you to starting and building EnviroSpark.
Okay, so I fell in love with sustainability actually in a prior job that I was doing, you know, while I was still in college at Georgia Tech. I ended up being a part of, it was a big corporate company, but I was part of a recycling arm of this organization. And what drew me most to the sustainability, I was on the business development side, but what I really enjoyed about it was, you know, one, just, you know, this feeling like I was doing something, you know, impactful that was making a difference. Or, you know, I feel like you can either make the world, you know, better or worse, or you can kind of be indifferent. But I felt like the work I was doing was actually, you know, beneficial to, you know, potentially future generations, and maybe the an opportunity for me to try to leave the world better than when I got here. And so there was that component of it. And then also the opportunity to kind of get other people to, you know, potential clients and prospects to consider playing their part or having a role in that same mission. What was really fun about it was not just the rewarding piece of feeling like I was doing something, but getting caught up in the excitement with others and getting them excited about what we did, and, you know, having that opportunity to say, you know, here's something that I think is important. I think maybe you should consider thinking it's important, and then kind of working with them through that. And what was neat was just that I never got buyer's remorse. Nobody ever said, oh, Aaron, I wish we hadn't helped the environment together. And and so that wasn't just a kind of an added bonus. But so that was kind of the start of it. I mean, I always had an interest in, you know, science and technology, you know, space travel and things like that. You know, I always was kind of frustrated because I was always awed by the beauty of the universe. You could look up and see, you know, everything that was out there, but there was no way for me to ever be able to go. And so if I could create an opportunity for others to be able to continue and potentially fulfill that, I thought that might be kind of cool. So that's kind of where it all started. I was really inspired by, you know, the speech that Carl Sagan gave. It's called Pale Blue Dot. I think everybody should check it out. It's very short, but you okay. can look it up. And I, you know, for me, it was just something that always stuck with me, and it was very inspirational. But it was just kind of about the kind of end theme of it, or the thrust of it, is just kind of, you know, we only have, you know, one planet, and it's all of our responsibility collectively to take care of it. And a lot of the other things that we think are important, like ideologies and religions and all these other things that we place so much importance on, you know, are in terms of, none of that matters if we destroy the one place that we actually live. So really, really enjoyed that. Started to get my feet wet in the business world. There were things about kind of the corporate environment that didn't really, you know, resonate well with me. Just kind of feeling like you're a cog in a wheel, feeling like you couldn't be creative in order to support your clients. Like, you kind of had a certain way that you had to do things because that's the way it's done. And for someone like me, it's like, I want to come up with something, you know, when I'm working with somebody to develop a solution, I want to come up with a way that we can, you know, best serve their needs and also serve the needs of the company that I represent and I work for, and I'm responsible to, you know, making sure that they make a profit, you know, if it's a for-profit company. But I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. And so, the you know, not having that opportunity to kind of be creative and kind of being stuck in this one-size-fits-all type of this is the only thing we can offer, we can't get creative with how we structure things or how we support or serve our customers was frustrating. And then also just kind of feeling like I think, like, there's this corporate mentality sometimes that, you know, maybe people sense when you're working at a big corporation that's just kind of like, I feel like they're trying to squeeze everything out of me without giving as much back or giving, you know, an equal amount back in return for the, either the value that's created or the effort that's put in. And so that's what kind of prompted me to go and start my own recycling company, like very shortly out of college. So after I graduated from Georgia Tech, I started a recycling business, and that company's, you know, going on something like 18 years. And you know, had the opportunity to partner up with it with someone who had started businesses before, kind of had the finance side of things covered. And so I would go out and do the business development. He would kind of run the financial side of the business, and we were able to grow that company very successfully over the course of several years and do, you know, what would end up becoming the blueprint for EnviroSpark in terms of how we set things up, how we grow regionally, nationally, and then internationally, and then continue to expand and operate the business. And so, you know, for the first 8 years after founding my recycling company, we were just building the business. And then we got it to a point where I was able to get out of the day-to-day running of that business and kind of consider starting another venture. And I wanted to do something else. I wanted to make even more of an impact. Okay, I've done the recycling thing. What else in sustainability can I do to make a difference and make an impact? And around the same time that I was getting out of the day-to-day, I married my, you know, best friend from college. You know, Stephanie and I met in undergrad at Georgia Tech. We were best friends in college. We had a number of classes together. We would always partner up for projects and all this stuff. And I like to joke that she was my first sale at EnviroSpark because she was being recruited. So she just finished her master's at Georgia Tech, and she's being recruited by a bunch of consulting firms, a lot of really exciting, neat opportunities. And you know, here I am, and I'm getting ready to start another business. I'm like, why don't we start something together? It'll be like college, where we'd do all these fun projects together. It'll be like doing a project together, but you know, who knows? Maybe we can make a difference. And we always had so much fun together. And so that's been a really interesting and unique component, I think, about the growth of our company, is just kind of that intertwined story of not only building our company and building, you know, the family at EnviroSpark, which we see, you know, all of our employees, nearly 150 employees now as part of an extended family, but growing our own family at the same time. So we have three boys, you know, they're 8, 7, and 8 months. And so, I mean, I think we can only make boys. I don't know. We'll see. But, and so it's been a really exciting journey. And so, you know, we'd gotten married, and I'm trying to think of, you know, what's another sustainability focused business that I could start. We're on our honeymoon. And so we'd been saving like sky miles and hotel points and all sorts of things for years and years and years. And we ended up doing this, you know, several month around the world trip. And, you know, in addition to just kind of enjoying, you know, traveling and doing different things and enjoying our honeymoon, we also ended up writing what would become the business plan for EnviroSpark. I was, interestingly enough, thinking about, you know, things like solar and energy storage and LED retrofitting. I mean, anything that I thought I might be able to get involved in that would have some sort of sustainable impact. And she's, you know, I've always been a little sheepish to admit, but she was the one who, you know, told me about Tesla, and I never knew who Elon Musk was until she was like, oh, this company looks interesting, and, you know, look at this guy. And, you know, there was a moment during our honeymoon where I think Tesla had opened up, you know, open sourced all their patents and said any manufacturer that wants to use our patents can do so. And so that was an interesting headline, and she showed me that. And it's amazing how much things have changed, because, I mean, this is not that long ago. This is like 2014.
It's not, yeah.
I, along with most people I would meet at the time, had no idea, you know, who Elon Musk was, or knew very little or nothing at all about Tesla or electrification in the auto industry. And if you fast forward just 10 years, I mean, you know, he's one of the most controversial, talked about, you know, people in the universe, and at one point richest man in the universe, and all these things. And this is somebody who literally less than 10 years ago, most people hadn't heard of. And when you think about it through that perspective, it's an interesting highlight just for the growth that both Tesla, the EV industry, and EnviroSpark have all kind of followed over that 10 years. Talking about that and kind of looking into, well, that looks interesting. This company looks kind of cool. And we started looking at, you know, why would anyone want to switch to an electric car? Why would it be a good thing if the auto industry went electric? The more we looked into it, the more we realized this would be objectively a very good thing. if the auto industry went electric over the course of time into the future, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, it would be an objectively good thing for a large number of reasons. And I could talk about those for a very long time. If we want to touch on those, we can. But there were lesser known components to electrification that I think people don't think about that are actually really impactful if you're aware of them and you consider them. Because I do think there's something for everyone. I don't think it matters what side of the aisle you're on. I don't think it matters if you believe in climate change or not. I think that there's a lot of very compelling reasons that an all-electric future for the auto industry is would be a very good thing.
Yeah, so. Agreed. I had to convince my husband to get the first Tesla. But my main driver was the cost of gas and how volatile that can be. And showing him the numbers really helps. But I also love the sustainability component of it and how today we have a smog alert in the city. And I know that my drive did not impact that. And that's great.
Well, and that's, I mean, the number one contributing factor to poor air quality in cities is combustion vehicles. And not just like from a, kind of makes our city look a little dingy with the smog. It's like there is an objectively true correlation between air quality and respiratory illness and death. Mm-hmm. Even every time you remove a vehicle that is contributing to poor air quality, perhaps you've helped one less kid get asthma or one family have more time with a loved one who otherwise would have succumbed to a respiratory condition, right? And so that's just one of the reasons. But then there's the practical ones, like you mentioned as well, which is just not only is like electricity a lot less expensive than gas, but you also kind of get to have a gas station at your home, right? Like you just get to wake up with a full tank whenever you want. And then there's also a lot less maintenance on the vehicles. So there's something like maybe one part for every 100 in a combustion vehicle. So there's one part in an electric car for every 100, something like that. So there's a lot less things to go wrong, a lot less components that have to be manufactured, all those kind of things. And even I forget all the things I don't have to do. So I don't have to go out of my way somewhere I otherwise wouldn't have gone to refuel. I get to wake up with a, fully stocked gas tank every day. I've never changed the brakes. We have a 2014, a Model S, that I've never changed the brakes on. So no brake changes. There's no oil changes. There's no oil in the vehicle.
Nope.
And then, there's a lot of cool technology, too. I mean, if you're into the whole autopilot or self-driving thing, I mean, it's a game changer for things like that.
Yeah. So. And they keep innovating. They keep pushing things. And it's great to do that. But it looks like the base reason to switch to electric, that's still there. That's not being taken away just because they're continuing to add things onto the car, and that's great.
It's funny. We mentioned the autonomous thing, but there are people who are like, really? You let a car drive you? And I mean, no offense, but I mean, it just to me, it's like the self-driving is better than any like Uber driver. I've had.
Human error is a thing. I don't remember the statistic, but it's significantly worse.
And so that's another interesting thing about electrification is that when you think about it, you have this vehicle that has just sensors and different types of cameras and all sorts of safety features looking in 360 degrees all at one time. It's not going to get distracted, like checking its text messages or talking to other cars or whatever, fiddling with the radio. It's programmed to avoid dangerous situations, stop at stop signs, red lights, all sorts of cool things. And when you think about the statistical and just you take the emotional piece out of it and you just look at the statistics, it is significantly safer to be driving in a Tesla with the autopilot on than driving yourself. Just if you look at the sheer number of miles that are driven on autopilot and the number of accidents that occur or fatalities, I mean, pick your stat. And then you look at the same number of miles driven by the average person, it's not even close in terms of the number of accidents that happen, when a human is driving versus the vehicle. Yeah. But what gets focused on is that one time that it doesn't. And there could have been 10,000 accidents or fatalities that happened from human error during the same time frame or the same amount of miles that were driven. But that one time that the system malfunctioned or something, that gets all the press and it gets people very worked up. And so you've kind of got to have these two competing kind of ways of looking at it. You have kind of that emotional response where anybody who just feels like, when you're giving up control, it's the same idea behind certain people are afraid of flying or something, right?
Yeah.
Even though statistically it's way, way safer than your drive to the airport. There are people who feel less safe because they don't have that control. And so I think it's the same thing conceptually. But I don't know, once you have used it enough, I think you get very comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, for me, it's like, well, if something happens, I mean, the chances of something happen would have been less than if I'd been driving myself. So, you know, so be it or whatever.
But yeah.
It's like they're kind of programmed to avoid stuff like that. So we'll mm-hmm. see. I don't know.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things that it tells me it sees that I don't necessarily see. And mm-hmm. I feel more comfortable with it the more I drive it. Mm-hmm. So shifting back to EVs in general, how have you seen at EnviroSpark the goals and vision evolve over the decade?
You know, we've always been a mission-driven company, and that vision kind of started, you know, on the beach in Bali or something, you know, when we were kind of workshopping business ideas. And we found out pretty quickly that, like I was saying earlier, one of the main barriers to, you know, EV adoption is just the access to refueling infrastructure, right? This fear that you're going to get stuck somewhere. And so we set about to promote electrification in two primary ways. The first part was just raising awareness for a lot of the benefits we just talked about. And so that was kind of always the vision. We wanted to get the word out there of, like, you know, and get people to consider, you know, some of the reasons why it might be a good thing. And, you know, we understand it's not for everybody, but we're hoping that people are open to at least being made aware of things that you could consider that might be a good thing about why they might want to get an electric car. And so the awareness piece was part of it. That's always been a part of our focus. And then, you know, the actual business around deploying charging stations, you know, in places where they maybe otherwise wouldn't have been in order to help encourage people. And that's really, that focus has not changed. I mean, in terms of the awareness piece, I think people know a little bit more about mm-hmm. electric cars, that they exist and that maybe there's some benefits to that. There's still some work to be done on the lesser known side of that. But we still very much believe one of the most important things that we can be doing and should be doing is just continuing to build out the infrastructure that's going to support wide scale adoption. Because, yeah, I mean, if you get, you know, if somebody's considering it, and let's say they are aware of all the benefits, right, mm-hmm. or they're kind of bought in, but they're still concerned about not having access to charging, if they go to their office and there's stations there, and then they go to their gym and there's stations there, and they go to their grocery store and their bank mm-hmm. and they have some at their condominium or their apartment, you start to get very comfortable with the idea. And then also just talking to other people that are electric vehicle owners and realizing I don't have to go anywhere to charge at all unless I'm on a road trip or something.
I don't think I've used a public charging station yet, but that's also because we haven't been comfortable with the road trip aspect just yet. But we're going into, like, Mississippi. The infrastructure still needs to be built there.
it can be done. And it's a lot better now than when we did. I mean, we road tripped across the U.S. My wife and I and our two kids at the time. We had a meeting at Tesla Corporate. And instead of flying, you know, in a week, we were like, oh, we'll drive out there. And so we did a cross-country drive. You know, it was a little bit different at the time. I've looked at that route since then, and now it's a very straight shot. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was very up, down, over, and back, and then there were certain areas where you just had to kind of get creative and stop at a hotel and look in the wall or something. Yeah, now the ranges are getting a lot better. There's more infrastructure available, and I always thought that was interesting, people saying, man, you know, you got to stop for 30 minutes when you're on a road trip or something like that. And I'm like, how many times do you have to stop at a gas station that mm-hmm. you otherwise wouldn't have gone to every month? So, you know, yeah, maybe the one road trip I go on, I have to stop for 30 minutes somewhere. Whereas, you know, for you every week or every other week, you have to go somewhere and sit for 5 or 10 and just go out of your way. And then the other thing that I think is interesting is some people say, you know, well, you know, yeah, that's like 30 minutes, you know, you won't get back or whatever. But, you know, off the record, you know, that 4-hour drive for me, the autopilot on, is actually quite pleasant. It's not a big deal to me. And then lastly, I mean, for me, it's like road tripping. If I've been driving 4 or 5 hours, I'm ready to stop and grab a bite to eat and use a restroom and stuff anyway. So it's such a rare thing now, especially because I'm not on the road as much these days. And there's nothing better than the convenience of just waking up with a full tank. So it's a different type of way of thinking about it. And I think there's a common misconception that we're going to mm-hmm. have to replace every fuel pump at a gas station with an EV charger in the future. And that's just not, maybe 10% of them. And you've basically covered the needs of a fully electrified auto industry, in my opinion. Yeah. Because right now, I mean, it's already something like 15 or what is it? You know, only 15% of all charging right now, or one of the most recent studies I saw, was done in a public setting. And I think that is also just partly because a lot of people, you know, 30% of Americans live in apartments and condos and just mm-hmm. don't have access to charging. And that's one of the areas that we're really focused on and trying to bring that capability to. But I just think if you're not on a road trip, you know, there's no need to have to go to a gas station. You know, I think that'll present some interesting challenges for gas station fueling operators and things like that in the future, because almost every American will have the ability to just have a gas station in their garage. Mm-hmm. And so what does that that mean for them in terms of their expectation? You know, not only selling fuel, but then selling all the stuff in the convenience store. Because how many times you go to a convenience store, like a gas station, and buy something from the store part of it if you didn't have to refuel there?
You know, maybe Buc-ee's has something on that already because they've made themselves a destination that happens to sell gas, apparently.
Right, right. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. The other thing that they have to contend with is just, you know, they can now anyone with access to power in a parking lot is a potential competitor. Mm-hmm. So any mall, any restaurant, literally anyone, any type of retail venue that has a parking lot and power can be a refueling provider if they want to. We'll see what happens. I mean, it's been a wild ride so far, and I think there's more bumps and highs and lows.
Yeah. You know, absolutely.
And shakeups.
Speaking of that, because we know that the past 10 years of EV space were talking about it a little bit of it being kind of a roller coaster. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced at EnviroSpark while you're building the company?
So the one that was first and foremost for us was always, I think, for lack of a better metaphor, it'd be the chicken and egg situation that you're in, where you're trying to convince site hosts, potential locations where we might be able to install EV chargers to make them accessible to the public or to residents at a community or something like that, or at a workplace. And they'll say, oh, well, we don't have any electric vehicle drivers here. I always thought that was interesting because big focus for us is the multi-family space. We're trying to install stations where anyone at an apartment or condo can refuel, because that's very compelling, I think, for someone who's considering getting an electric car to now go, I can wake up with a full tank when I want, instead of I have to go to the mall and sit for 30 minutes once a week, or go to the gas station and sit for 30 minutes once a week or whatever. And so that's been a big focus for us. But then you kind of get that response, well, we don't have any electric vehicle drivers. Why would we need that? And the truth of the matter is, what we find is that the people that either want to get an electric car or have one they're avoiding that. They're not living at that property because they want that convenience. They want the ability to charge. And so you're kind of continuing with this, this mentality is like, we don't need that because we don't have any drivers. But of course you don't have any drivers because you don't have the charging, right?
They're
going somewhere else. And we've seen that. We have access to a lot of data. We've been doing this for 10 years. We've installed 8,000 plus stations. And time and time again, we are seeing that just by the virtue of that station being in that location, you start to see, especially in the residential, like the multifamily residential space, you start to see people as they're turning over their leases or getting a new vehicle. They are making the conscious decision to get an electric car that they otherwise wouldn't have made had there not been a station there. And they went, oh, now I can get an electric car for my next car. And so now it's the evidence is just overwhelming that there is a very real impact of just, even if you don't have any electric vehicle drivers at a property or a workplace, that you will have them just by installing the station. That will encourage people to get them. And if you believe in the reasons why electrification is a good thing, then it's something worth considering. And we make it very easy. If somebody wants to do an EV charging project, we have a lot of ways to help make that happen. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't have the money to do it, even if they don't want to deal with the headaches of managing a refueling station, whatever, we have built a lot of different offerings and solutions to be able to cater. And it goes back to the very first thing I was talking about, just the difference between kind of a big corporate environment and having a small business, is that you have a lot more freedom to be able to create solutions that will be really impactful or beneficial and help people make a decision to do a sustainability-focused project that they otherwise wouldn't have chosen to do had we not been able to set it up a certain way or structure it or help them out. And that's just not conducive to one-size-fits-all, this is the only way we do things model. We really enjoy having the opportunity to take in just 10 years worth of feedback from site hosts, landowners, drivers, utilities, jurisdictions, cities, states, counties, federal government, auto OEMs. We've worked with every major auto OEM, every major hardware and software manufacturer of EV charging solutions. We've gotten to work with all of them and get feedback on all those different things and then create new solutions that kind of meet needs in the industry that weren't being met anywhere else. And it's been really exciting to have had the opportunity and the freedom to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. What are a few key lessons that you've learned throughout the journey?
Oh, we've learned a lot. I don't think you're a good entrepreneur if you haven't learned some serious lessons along the way. And interestingly enough, I mean, one of the things that I found was so incredibly important for us and probably works in any industry, but especially in sustainability, was finding the right, people and culture are so important. But that early stage team, when you have kind of a close, we're talking about family, like these guys and Girls. We're like family. And having everyone bought into that mission to where it's like we are all working towards something greater than ourselves, you know, seeing the benefits of that. And then every once in a while, those situations where maybe we brought in somebody who, you know, it's just a paycheck for them, or maybe they're good at their job, but they're not passionate about what we're trying to do. And they don't care about being part of something bigger. Or they don't believe that what we're doing is really impactful or meaningful. And just recognizing the incredible intangible value of, because you can't look at that on a resume, right? Like you can't, like, I mean, maybe they can say, I'm super passionate about sustainability, but oftentimes you're not going to get that through the resume. You're going to get that when you meet them. And so that's a big part of our, yeah, it's been a very big part of our kind of interviewing and onboarding process and hiring process, is just making sure that the people we're bringing on are a good cultural fit with the company. And I mean, the importance of that is equal to, if not greater than, the actual, you know, capabilities of the individual, because people that are bought in are willing to do, they're willing to do anything for the company. And like you, as a small business, you know, you have to wear so many hats. And then the more you grow, the more you get to start creating divisions of labor and specializations and things like that. But the people that are willing to do whatever it takes because they believe in the mission, and it's what's in the best interest of the greater mission, not just the company itself, but what the company is trying to achieve, I think was really important. And so we had some lessons learned with a few hires where it was just kind of, it wasn't the right fit. And we could have recognized that. And we kind of had a thought that maybe that was the case, but is it really that big a deal? They're really good at what they do. But then the moment you got to roll up your sleeves or get in the weeds or do whatever it takes that's beyond what their expectations were, they're not willing to do that. I think that was a really interesting one for us. There's probably a few others that I could speak to, but I think the other big one for us was just putting a lot of eggs in one basket from a client standpoint. I mean, we owe a lot of our growth to major industry players, and that was always part of our strategy. We wanted to see who was trying to do big things that were aligned with our mission. And in the space that we were in, and then how could we support them being a nimble small business startup, and how could we adjust to better help them do big things. And so we owe so much of our growth to Georgia Power and Tesla and Nissan and some of these early partnerships that we had. And what would end up happening is sometimes you'd have a partner that very finely attuned to serving their ambitions as a builder of infrastructure. And we, you know, you don't want to say no. Especially for someone like me, I don't want to say no. If a big client wants us to do more for them, I don't want to pass that opportunity up or risk the possibility of them not being able to do what they want to do because I wasn't able to help support it. You know, you think, oh, well, maybe they can find somebody else to help support that, but I already know they're not going to be able to support it as well as we could. And so, you know, maybe there's a way we could continue to grow. And so there were times where we were just really clicking along with, you know, one vendor or another, and it's like all of a sudden all of your business starts to shift towards that one company, and you're starting to tailor everything that you do towards being able to serve that, because it's such a good relationship and they're doing such impactful work in the space. And on a dime, we've had those programs shift. We've been caught off guard past. You don't have a diversified enough client base, or you start shifting everything. You're not giving as much attention to the other guys that you know.
Yeah.
And you can't do it all. And so managing that has been a process and figuring out how to do it. But very quickly having to go back to somebody that you weren't working with as much anymore and now ask for all the work that's going to make up for the person that you were actually giving the attention to, it's not ideal. Or having to go find a new, you know, a new partner. And that can be pretty harrowing when you're growing organically. So we never, like, the only investment in VirusSpark was $5,000 for the first 7 years. We just grew profitably over the years, and we didn't actually raise any money until we decided to start covering all the costs for people that wanted to get charters that couldn't afford them. Mm-hmm. That's when we went out to raise money to kind of, you know, test that idea out, because we had so many apartments and condos where we just felt it would be such a good thing if we had chargers there. And, you know, they wanted them, or they had residents that wanted them, and they either didn't have the budget for it, or the HOA would say, well, why would we spend everybody's money on something for a handful of people? And so that's when we came up, that was based on all this feedback. That's when we came up with this idea of, like, maybe we could go back to them and say, what if we cover all the costs, and all we ask for in return is the opportunity to, we'll just charge the people that are using the stations. They'll get the amenity they want. You don't have to pay for it. and we'll deal with the management of the stations, and we'll pay for all the operation and maintenance and the installation. And it kind of aligned everybody's interest. And so that was a huge hit. But it all started with an initial, kind of seed investment to test that model out specifically. Mm-hmm. And every subsequent fundraise since then was built off of the momentum of that particular program of being able to offer this solution for people who very much needed it and could benefit from it if they just had something like that that they could, mm-hmm. they could call on or lean on. So
yeah, and so that's opened up a whole new world. Seen some good news for you guys out there in the news, like different partnerships and mm-hmm. new fundraising announcements. So how does that, if you can share anything, like what are your plans for the future based on all of those new pieces that are rolling in?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is we've got a kind of an opportunity right now to continue serving in a number of different capacities that we've always done and we've always done very well at, and to continue to expand on that. And we've got the opportunity to do that with the recent fundraise that we closed on. I mean, it probably wasn't even 2 months ago at this point. And, we had very aggressive plans to continue building out infrastructure in the multifamily sector. And that was a big piece for us, because if 30% of Americans live in a multifamily environment, and most of those multifamily environments today don't have access to charging, that's a significant portion of the population that may not be as likely to get an electric car. And so that's been a big focus for us. We also want to continue building out the national networks for, so Tesla is a big client of ours, Volkswagen, Shell, Racetrack, Circle K. That is a very important part of the ecosystem as well. And we want to continue building out all of that public charging that allows people to feel comfortable going on road trips and things mm-hmm. like that. So we're going to continue helping leverage our experience designing and building and maintaining and setting up those types of locations, while also kind of meeting the needs, the adoption needs of people that live in the multifamily market. And so that's where we are setting up a similar network to what these public charging companies are doing, setting up public charging and then making it available for anybody to come use. We're doing kind of a miniature version of that in the multifamily space mm-hmm. and setting up a network of stations, at all these apartments and condos that residents in those environments can then use. There's a lot of work to be done there. And so, our vision and our goal is to continue to be able to provide those services, as well as, leveraging all of our expertise building these national networks for the major players that are doing big things in that space. And so we mm-hmm. have these two different kind of arms of the business. We used to only have one. So for the first 7 years, all we did was design and build and construct, sites for other people. And if somebody, mm-hmm. if you were an apartment or a condo that wanted an EV charger, we would give you a price and say, here's what the hardware and the installation cost is going to be, and here's what it's going to cost for us to design and pull the permit and do all that. And then we added this other layer, which is just, if they can't afford that, there's still a way that we can help them get EV charging. We just want to continue expanding on that, mm-hmm. In all areas of the charging ecosystem. And that includes like workplace and hospitality as well. We love working with, office buildings, and we'll see how remote work plays out, because just there's so many less people now that go into an mm-hmm. office all the time, but we still want to help support that if we can. And then obviously hotels. What's interesting about the hotel scene is that, for me as an EV owner, I don't know if you guys, you said you haven't gone on a road trip yet in your electric mm-hmm. car, but for me, that convenience of being able to wake up with a full tank, I want to have that at whatever hotel I'm staying at.
And yes.
So that's another area where we can continue to roll out infrastructure. It's why we partnered with IHG and, other hospitality groups to make that same experience available to EV owners. And again, just get people more comfortable. If they've got a charger at their home, and then, when they travel, they're going to these hotels, and all the hotels have chargers. Like, man, I can do anything.
Great.
This is great. So,
I've noticed it in a few places. I haven't been in my Tesla, but mm-hmm. I've noted it down of like, okay, here's ways that I can convince that a road trip will work, because we're starting to see those at hotels, even in smaller areas, more rural. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great way to expand and get it into those spaces where it's not typically just yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be cool to see how that keeps growing.
Yeah, there's still a ton of work to be done. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. have the exact statistics, but the number of stations that are currently available versus what's going to be needed, as the EV industry continues to evolve and grow, and all these manufacturers are now offering these big lines of electric cars, mm-hmm. it's just astronomical when you look at the number of stations that are going to be required to support that. I mean, even conservative estimates, there's just a ton of work to be done. And so we're really excited to be in a position to do that, especially kind of, it's funny because there's certain industries industry players that are pulling back a little bit, and there are some mm-hmm. that are really kind of pushing ahead. And, you know, there seems to be more of a focus on the ones, Tesla, you know, doing layoffs or
you
know, things like that, and less of a focus on, you know, wow, like Hyundai finished their U.S. EV manufacturing plant early, and Cadillac is seeing crazy growth in their, you know, EV sales. And so I think it's tempered, but that the tempering is not being communicated as much as the negative.
It's really not.
The media, so.
I haven't even heard of those last mm-hmm. two stories, and that's good to know.
Well, and those are just some examples, but there's you know, several others. And so, you know, it's funny, the Tesla thing actually is interesting because when we recently closed our most recent raise, the $50 million round, we had a very aggressive hiring plan and headcount growth that we were going to be using this fundraise for. And it's always been daunting to me, this idea of continuing to try and maintain the culture and finding the right people, you know, as you're continuing to scale quickly and bigger mm-hmm. and faster. So we're thinking, man, this is going to be tough, but we can do it. We're up for it. We've thought it through. And then you know, we're going to fill these spots. We're going to develop these guys, and we're going to find the right people. The day after we close the round, and you know, the very next day, you know, Elon Musk fires the entire Tesla infrastructure team. The entire team that would built their whole network that I had worked with over the last 10 years building this national network and even internationally working with them in Canada, building out all these sites, every person that I worked with was out of a job. You know, these were all people that lived and breathed EV charging. They had the same cultural values as us. We were very closely connected with them. We knew them well. And so we kind of opened it up and said, anybody, you know, from Tesla that, you know, is interested, you know, from the infrastructure team that's interested in continuing to do what you love and being part of a team that has the same values and culture, shoot us a note, send us an application. And, you know, we received something like 150 applications out of, you know, the 500 people that were laid off from that mm-hmm. team. So you know, almost one third of the whole team. And very quickly, within a week or two, we'd already hired, you know, 16 or 17 the ex-Tesla team members that we had worked with. I don't know, it was like bittersweet. I felt really bad about how it all went down, but then also really happy that we could provide an environment where they could continue to mm-hmm. do everything that they already did and loved and be a part of that mission still. And it's been really fun working with those guys on the same side of the table, because both companies had brought different elements. It was part of the same goal and the same mission and the same projects that we were working on collaboratively, but for them to kind of bringing all the expertise from the Tesla side and for us to be able to kind of take what we were doing and, you know, use that to you know, further enhance our team and our capabilities has been extremely exciting and rewarding.
Speaking of, like, when you're talking about challenges of scaling and trying to keep the company culture, what are some of the ways that you balance innovation, growing the business, keeping the culture, but keeping the practicality in check as well?
What do you mean when you say practicality?
Making sure you have, like, books balanced, certain things like that, ensuring that operations is running smoothly mm-hmm. when there are changes in the market, things like that.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, the bigger you get, it's funny, I started my own business to get away from the rigid corporate structure mm-hmm. and, you know, all the things that I disliked about working in a big corporate environment. And the bigger you get, the more you start to resemble some of that. And so you understand it. You understand why, you know, they do things the way they do. It still felt to me, you know, why. Some of the things were just, we do them because that's the way we do them. And there didn't seem to be a reason. But I now do understand some of the things that why corporations have to do things the way that they mm-hmm. do. Because once you have investors and you are basically going to be investing a lot of money in the company, you're not just growing organically. Like, as you make money, you then reinvest that. You now have an amount of money that you can invest that, you know, wasn't generated by it being profitable. It was generated through an investment. The way that you approach that is a little bit different. I mean, it's always been in our DNA to be very fiscally responsible because we had to be, but then you also feel this pressure to make the most of an investment. There's kind of some friction there between the way you've always done things in terms of being extremely cash conscious and making sure that you don't do anything unless you know you've already gotten a profit that's going to cover that. Now you're having to make decisions about, okay, if we invest in this, we've got to make sure that that's going to be profitable in the future. And so it's been an adjustment in terms of thinking about how we deploy capital, having that shift from, you know, okay, we know that we've now made this much, we can then reinvest it. It's we have this much to invest. and we have to make sure that we make more that we can then reinvest or, you know, whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so, and then also just the dynamics, right, of having third parties involved in the company that just create additional perspective. And so there's a lot of benefits to that. And then there's also, you know, areas or times where maybe interests aren't fully aligned, right? And that's the any corporation with shareholders or stakeholders, but, you know, and then there's short and long-term interests that have to be balanced, right? And so there's just more dynamics at play, and like having to kind of navigate and figure some of that out has required just some additional learning and adjustments and lessons learned and things like that. But we've done a really good job of managing most of that. And I would say for me, what's been fun is that I used to, you know, I have an executive team of maybe 8 or 9 people now that run departments. You know, at some point I probably did between me and my wife, you know, we did every single job that now is being covered at that level. And so having to learn to let go of some of that has been challenging for me as an entrepreneur. I think it's one of the most difficult things when you know you could do something, like, and maybe that's today. Like, I know I could do this thing that this person's about to do better than they could. I should probably do that. You can only do that in so many areas. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you shouldn't be doing that anymore at a certain point. And so it's being able to understand that, like, even though I could do it better than maybe that individual, it's still not the best use of my time to do that thing. And that there are other responsibilities that now need to be tended to, and separating that. And then, you know, what's been most rewarding is if you find the right people, both from a cultural and a capability standpoint, that thing that you would have done better than them because you didn't do it for them and they've now done that thing, they're better than you at doing it, has been extremely rewarding. But, you know, when you're in that process of having to start delegating more and more and trusting your team and their capabilities, it can be difficult to do. But when you come out of it, it's highly rewarding. It's almost like, you know, I don't know, like a really tough day at the gym, you know, mm-hmm. where you've had a grueling, you know, workout. And it was really tough during the workout itself, but then afterwards it's highly rewarding. And then grinding that out day in and day out and continuing to kind of go through that grind during the process, you don't see it, but then you can look back and see the results over time.
It resonates with me. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it resonates with a lot of other people as well. Mm-hmm. Shifting focus a little bit more on personal insights and more localized, aside from maybe geography of Atlanta being home, how has the city of Atlanta fostered your growth as a leader, and how has EnviroSpark benefited from being a part of the Atlanta tech community?
We owe a lot to our Atlanta community for a number of different reasons. I mean, I don't even know where to start because it's been, I never would have guessed, you know, 10 years ago, I don't think me or Stephanie would have guessed just what an incredible ecosystem for sustainability in Atlanta and Georgia would become. And so to kind of get to grow alongside that, it's been an incredible experience. And, you know, we actually considered, you know, starting the business in California, right? Mm-hmm. There seems to be more interest and awareness for EVs in California, and it already seems to be kind of getting some traction. Maybe we should, you know, start out there where there's more business. And, you know, we talked about it more, and at the end of the day, we just decided, you know, it's home for us. It's our community. And what if we could bring, you know, the economic development here? What if we could bring the benefit here of electrification, bring better air quality to Atlanta? There's already people focusing on that in California. What if we could bring that to our own community and start here? And then also, you know, we had found out Georgia Power, you know, was starting to take an interest in electrification, and they wanted to do big things. And we're like, what if we could be a part of that and help them and serve Georgia Power and their efforts? And so we've served, you know, through multiple iterations of different incentive programs designed to promote EV adoption and deploy infrastructure to better support growth. And so just we were like, man, we could make Atlanta kind of a mecca of EV adoption and EV charging in the Southeast. And so we started here. And also Tesla had just opened a showroom in Marietta at the time. Yeah. And that's actually kind of how we got our start with Tesla is, I mean, I'll never forget it. I taught myself how to install the little home charger that you put in on the wall. I don't know if you have one at your house. Yeah, exactly. So, and I would go up there to the showroom and I would just kind of beg them, if somebody buys a Tesla, can I go to their house and put the charging station in? And they're like, who is this guy? No, you can't, random guy. Like, what are you, do you even have a license to do that? Like, so, and I would talk to Stephanie. I'm like, Stephanie, you know, having a hard time getting some traction. You know, maybe I should take these guys to dinner or lunch or something, bring something in. You know, I'll never forget it. She said, I got you. What you need to do is like go to Krispy Kreme and get coffee and donuts and take that to him every time you go see him. We started bringing him coffee and donuts like every month. And she called it donut diplomacy, but TM. it was kind of funny. They started looking forward to the guy that would come in with the coffee and donuts, and eventually we got the opportunity to start installing for people that were buying Teslas, and the relationship grew from there. You know, then it grew into a commercial relationship, and then, you know, in Georgia, and then, you know, regionally in the Southeast, and then nationally, and then internationally. And it all started with just kind of going mm-hmm. in and asking to install chargers. To bring it back to Atlanta, we got the opportunity to grow in, with Georgia Power, and so much is owed to them, and frankly, like the Public Service Commission and Tim Echols for all the work that he's done in support of EV adoption and electrification. And I mean, even the economic development team for the state, like Pat Wilson, I mean, those guys are kind of the unsung heroes, bringing all these incredible companies to Georgia, you know, like SK Battery makes the batteries for a lot of these EVs, and you know, Hyundai and their new plant in Savannah, and just everything that's going on. Rivian, there's so much going on here from an automotive and a sustainability standpoint, and so much of that is owed to just this collaboration between all these different parties that have all done their part to create this ecosystem. And I think I read somewhere, I mean, there was more investment in the state of Georgia maybe last year, I think it was clean tech, than maybe any other state in the country.
Yeah, I think I read the same statistic. Who would have thought?
Well, we never would have predicted that 10 mm-hmm. years ago. And then even just beyond that, I mean, our seed round that we did. So when we went and we said, we're going to try out this idea of covering the cost for apartments and condos so that their residents can get electric cars, we kind of made a list of 40 high net worth Atlanta business leaders. And, you know, we're looking at this list, you know, and like, man, I hope we can convince some of these guys to maybe be interested in getting involved with us. You know, let's see how it goes. And we kind of straight up shark tanked it, kind of like just come in with, you know, and you get 30 minutes and you have to pitch your idea and then see how it goes and see if there's any interest there. And for those reasons, you know, fortunately, you know, the first four said yes, and we were off to the races. And we owe a lot to those individuals. Like, we wouldn't be here at the point that we're at today without their support. And these are, you know, prominent Atlanta business leaders, you know, Home Depot, Delta, Chick-fil-A, Georgia Power, yeah, those kinds of individuals. And so, you know, there's a lot there that's owed for not only just, you know, them throwing us a few bucks that allowed us to then, you know, prove this concept that allowed us to go get tens of millions of dollars worth of additional investment that we wouldn't have been able to get without that proof of concept. And it was a very small round, but then it ultimately allowed us to then go out and raise, you know, our first $15 million. And then that allowed us to go out and raise another $50 million to continue this really neat model that fits a very, you know, needed solution in the ecosystem in the EV adoption world. But it all started with this just straight up pitch of our idea, and would you be open to maybe helping support us? But not only did they support us financially, but they have just given us such a wealth of advice and knowledge, and these are very seasoned business leaders. And that proximity and that ability to kind of leverage those relationships and that knowledge has been incredibly impactful. The utility, the Public Service Commission, the local Tesla dealership, yeah, and then these incredible Atlanta business leaders, you know, all being involved in different ways.
Yeah. I would say, like, before I moved to Atlanta, I had no idea any of this would happen. But it's interesting seeing the ecosystem and how it works. Everybody works together. And even though they're leaders of different businesses, there's still a collaboration that I don't think is very common all over the place. Mm-hmm. I think that that's really helpful.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And even more recently, just like, we love our Atlanta partnerships. I mean, that's what we're like. You can never understand the level of excitement, you know, within our company when we signed on with these partnerships to embark on this journey with Waffle House or IHG. I mean, the idea, you know, for us, like, Waffle House is just a, well, it's near and dear to my heart because I kind of grew up very close to, you know, where Waffle House is, like, their corporate headquarters and where they started. Mm-hmm. And used to go with my family all the time and, you know, still take my family from time. And so, but what I love about Waffle House is, one, they're open 24/7, 365, and they have that reputation. So in terms of a site for travelers, I think they're a fantastic type of location. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, somebody like IHG, they have so much opportunity to make an impact on, I mean, I think they have 4,500 locations. The opportunity to make an impact by electrifying these locations, and for travelers to know that if I go to an IHG property, I'm going to be able to refuel my electric car, have that same experience that I have at home. We're so excited about that, not only because of the potential of just, you know, what it can do for the EV ecosystem, but also just because they are beloved home-based, you know, yeah, Atlanta, Georgia-based companies. that are around the corner from us. And so mm-hmm. we can just collaborate so closely with them to do really neat things. And, you know, that said, it's like we love those types of partnerships. And then, but we've also had to, you know, as we've expanded, you know, nationally and internationally, I mean, there's just so many more partnerships yeah. that have opened up and so much more work to be done. But it's kind of the local ones that will always have like that near and dear mm-hmm. place in our heart. And especially the ones that were involved in our kind of early growth and things like
yeah.
that.
So. Keeps that family feel.
Yeah. Yeah. So wait, when did you, so you're not from Atlanta?
I'm originally from Alabama. I moved around a bit, but I moved down from Charlotte mm-hmm. and I'm sure they have a similar, I don't know how their ecosystem works there. Mm-hmm. Just moving here, not knowing anything really about the city and then getting involved in commerce here. It's just been really, really great to see.
Okay. Yeah. And so when was that?
2016. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you've been here a little while, but I guess some of that was during COVID.
Yes. COVID was an interesting battle, but.
Yeah. Very cool. So yeah. Have you observed anything? I mean, that's a pretty good chunk of time. I mean, with you kind of being focused on the technology side of things, you know, here in Atlanta, have you noticed any, you know, kind of changes or interesting things that from your side, either, you know, with regards to electrification or clean tech?
Aside from reading the report, I noticed quite a bit in the past year, year and a half, how many more Teslas specifically, but I've seen Lucid, I've seen Rivian start to get on the road too, and just how interesting we're like an island in the southeast, so to speak, of just really having so much electrification rather rapidly. I would say I didn't have as much visibility into it until I attended Georgia Tech, and then that just opened up a whole world mm-hmm. from that perspective of seeing just all the different pieces in the ecosystem here of who's trying to bring commerce, more business, international business in, and then also try to solve for problems that we do have in the city. And I think that that is, I think it's great.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that. You mentioned Georgia Tech, too. I sadly left that one out. I mean, a special place in my heart for tech also, mm-hmm. just because that's where I met my wife and co-founder and best friend, and also just President Cabrera has been so supportive of the work that we're doing, sustainable initiatives and entrepreneurship in general, you know, is Georgia Tech and all that they're doing to kind of further sustainability and those budding students that are trying to make a difference as well. Yeah.
Do you have any parting words or maybe any books, podcast, anything to recommend for people that you felt helped influence your thinking and approach to the clean tech sector, to sustainability and commerce?
Interesting. Okay, so where I was initially going with it was there's an entrepreneur that I actually think is just, you know, he's really good, but he's got some things that are kind of quirky about it. But it's mm-hmm. actually less sustainability focused, it's more just kind of like entrepreneurial focused. And there's a lot of people who have really good ideas that, you know, never kind of act on them, and they could have done something really cool from an entrepreneurial standpoint. And so the main thing that so many people should consider if they have a good idea is, like, do I really have to get everything perfect in order to do this, or am I willing to take this risk? And mm-hmm. and so I think the number one thing that maybe prevents people from kind of taking that leap or that journey is just feeling like they have to get everything perfect or whatever. But once you do it and you're kind of in it, then you kind of just realize you're never going to know everything or have everything perfect, and you're always going to have to be adjusting. And so there's a really good entrepreneur that does a lot of, like, you know, he does podcasts and you know, kind of shorts and stuff. But his name's it's Hermosi. And but what his signature thing was, so he started out as, you know, he opened a gym and then he ended up kind of growing his business. I think he's so good. But the reason why is because I can just relate to so many of the things that he's been through, that he has a lot of legitimacy with me. Like, almost every single thing that he's describing or experience that he's learned from is something that a lot of them that I've gone through and learned from myself. And so then the ones that maybe I haven't got to yet or haven't really thought about in a certain way or learned that lesson yet, I can take him very seriously because he's been dead on every single thing that I've actually been through that he's been through. But I always joke that because, like, the guy, like, I don't know what it is, but he always, you know, he's always got this really great advice, but he's always wearing, like, gym clothes. He's, like, you know, and you know, he'll be sitting there doing the podcast, and he'll stand up at one point. He's wearing these, like, booty shorts or something. I'm just like, what is this guy? What is he doing? But I just think for anybody who's considering the entrepreneurial journey, I think he's got a lot of really good wisdom to impart. And then the other thing that I would think maybe just worth mentioning that we didn't get to talk on, which I always try to make it a point mm-hmm. to at least mention, is just, it's really important to me to try to change the narrative around trade work. Like this idea that if you're an electrician or you're a carpenter or you're a plumber or whatever, that and let's say you didn't go to college, but you went to trade school or you learned that trade and you got really good at that, that somehow that's like less important or less valid than getting $100,000 worth of debt, you know, for a liberal arts degree or whatever. And I can say that because I have a liberal arts degree. But I think there's been this narrative that has been perpetuated that's like, if you don't go and get a 4-year degree from college, you're somehow, you know, you can't get a real job or something like that. I think there's so many kids today that would, one, like just really enjoy that type of work. Like, I don't know, I wish I'd been exposed to the electrical trades sooner, because I actually really enjoy having this useful skill that's kind of exciting to me, and understanding how electricity works and electrons move around and being able to wire things up at the home and, you know, build things that people can use and enjoy. And you think about it, it's just like the fact that that is not as respected as it should be, I think, bothers me a little bit. Like if a kid told their mom, like, oh, I'm going to go be a plumber or whatever, or a carpenter, like they're like, you know, go to college, right? Like go get a ton of debt, maybe, you know, get a lifetime of debt and die, while you're still paying it off, or worse, you know, drop out. And so for me, it's been important to try to raise awareness, you know, for the opportunity that exists, the fun, the excitement, and, you know, to try to encourage people to, you know, join me, or if anybody has any good ideas on how we can, like, kind of change that narrative. And I think it starts at the younger generation.
It does, yeah.
But I think part of it's just exposing them to stuff like that at an early age. Like, oh, wow, this was really neat. You know, I can build stuff, or I can wire stuff up, or I can fix things, or I can do something useful and have this really neat skill. And by the way, you know, I can get paid to learn that skill. I can be making 6 figures within a couple of years.
Yeah.
Because there's so much opportunity, it's so needed. You know, if you ever want to start your own business, you have this skill that you can kind of start your business around. The entrepreneurial opportunities are endless. But I always try to sneak that in somewhere, just because I think it's really important.
It is. I worked in the built environment for 6+ years. And so with that, we would coordinate with a lot of general contractors and things like that. And increasingly, it became more difficult, especially after 2020, to find that skilled, even unskilled labor that they need to build what needs to be built. And it's just very interesting to see how that impacts quality, because you don't have enough people, how that's just been a challenge that a lot of people have been trying to figure out. But I have seen a couple of articles, and it's good to hear it from you too, so that narrative keeps going, is it's starting to change of you know, generations that are in high school right now. They're starting to graduate and just really consider where they want to go. And it's not looked the same as it was whenever I went to school or whenever you went to school. And hopefully that keeps shifting and we recognize and appreciate that we need people across the spectrum.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. I think it's a similar mission based type thing where, you know, you feel like you're doing something for future generations, but this idea of saving a kid today from a lifetime of debt, I don't know. Just it feels like you've done something good if you've provided that opportunity to somebody to do that, or at least told them it's okay to consider that path. And it's so needed right now. If nobody goes into those trades, it's just like, who's going to build all this stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a huge challenge.
And we all want stuff. Like we all want,
you know, we need stuff.
Yeah. Like building infrastructure and building new developments and housing and all these other things. And it doesn't exist without individuals. So. Yeah, right. Very cool. Thanks
you so much for taking the time today. Really great conversation. Really appreciate it.